Welcome to CoCurious, where we break free from conventional learning. My name is David McLean, and I host educational leaders to practically discuss measuring what matters, not just what's easy to count. We assess genuine learning beyond mere checkboxes, and we're interested in building sustainable futures instead of promoting endless growth cycles. CoCurious is powered by learningadvisory.com, and we're delighted you've joined us for this conversation. I've known Dr. Sarah Babb for nearly 20 years and continue to be inspired by the work and contribution Sarah makes to individuals and organizations. I've asked Sarah to come and share neurodiversity as a competitive advantage, with the subtext being building neuro-inclusive cultures. Neurodiversity as a competitive advantage to the uninitiated could sound counterintuitive based on the reputation neurodivergence has in society. Sarah, welcome. What is neurodiversity in its factual and scientific form?
Neurodiversity has different legs to it. Actually, the term is a social movement term that was coined about 30 years ago, and it was really beginning to phrase neurodiversity as a normal part of the human spectrum of our brains working differently. And this is a shift away from the medical disorder languaging around we have something wrong and we must fix it. So the pathology of there's something wrong and we must fix it. So what interests me is two parts to it. The one is that this is actually part of how do we view humans differently, working differently in the workplace? How do we include that otherness as an advantage? And I'll come back to that. And then the sort of medical terminology is also shifting. So around neurodiversity. So that's the second leg to how do we define this? So neurodivergence is where there is a normal spectrum or variation amongst the human population of how our brains function, how we engage socially, how we make sense of our environments. And neurodivergence then is particular behavioral traits that is quite broad. So it includes dyslexia, it includes the autism spectrum, it includes Tourette syndrome, it includes ADHD and other derivations of it. So if one thinks of our brains as being a spectrum, we all think differently, neurodiversity. And within that, there is a spectrum of neurodivergence, which has some common traits and ways of our brains functioning that we make sense of information, we make sense of social engagements, we make sense of our sensory experience in the world. And the notion of neurodivergence then is to say, even within that medical conversation, there's a contestation around terminology. So the model that many people refer to, or the medical terminology, comes from DSM-5, which is an American psychiatry definition, which is even beginning to take away words like disorder. It's not a disorder and that there's something wrong and if you fix it. Yes, some medication can help with focus. Yes, some medication in your toolbox can help many of us with different ways of functioning in the world, but it's not a temporary experience that you then need to fix. So how do we view this? How do we understand it on a human level beyond the medical phrasing of it? If we understand that, then we can begin to say, but in a profile within the spectrum, we have different strengths that we bring. We have different challenges that we bring. And the humanizing of the workforce. But for me, it also comes back to belonging and inclusion. As you said, there's differences in ages, there's differences in experiences of maybe older managers and how they view the younger generation. And in fact, the younger generation, many of them, and this is also generalizing, have had the experience in schools of perhaps being assessed or being more aware of neurodiversity. And the schools have found ways of accommodating that neurodiversity. So it's not, there's another whole debate about disability. You might say, and it's defined in South African law, that the mental impairment is a disability. And so if one views neurodiversity as a disability, then you might say that with some accommodations, like more time on an exam or like a person in a wheelchair having a ramp, that those accommodations then look beyond the disability and we then look at the human fully functioning, thriving, belonging, bringing their discretionary effort, bringing their brains, bringing their diverse thinking, which is the actual gift that we want from our humane workplaces. In many cases, we find workplaces are squishing that thinking, diversity, innovation, creativity, ideation, social connection, because there may be too much on the pendulum of hierarchy, of a toxic culture, of an unsafe environment. And so for me, we can't really have the conversation with neurodiversity without looking at belonging and inclusion. And so the notion being that if we build workplaces that are fully inclusive of every brain matters, that every person brings what they can to their roles, to their performance, to the team, to the productivity and outputs, then we have a good culture.
It's so all-encompassing. What you remind us of is how in seemingly more progressive environments, diversity of perspectives is valued. And let's say diversity of perspectives is encouraged and embraced and part of the lived experience, juxtaposed with the inconvenience of diversity. And what I'm also thinking of as I muddle through my own ignorances and prejudices is I wrote down the word trustworthy with a question mark. What is required of us to upskill ourselves so that we don't have a perception that people on the spectrum are less trustworthy because of the perception that they are mentally and emotionally erratic?
So let's pick up on some of those assumptions. And there's many co-occurrences of neurodivergence. But if one thinks of the typical notion of being on the autism spectrum, one of the strengths that is stated is that because it's hard to read social clues, because you are hyper-focused, you're gathering information on something you're interested in, because you can then solve problems, you can get deep into the detail, you may be missing out on terms of emotional connection with people around you. The irony is that actually the strength of this profile is because of that, many people on the spectrum will speak the truth. So they will state what's on their mind. So how do we define trustworthy? Isn't trustworthy, it's similar to integrity. You know what you're saying. I know where you stand. So surely I trust you more. So then the other notion that's also interesting is that if you're on the spectrum, many people like routines because it feels like there's less drawing away from attention, that would like the same predictability, stability. If we look at the workplace perspective, makes that profile more loyal and actually more likely to stay in the organization because change is so disruptive. So is that also not more trustworthy? That you know, if you really have included the strengths, many people on the spectrum are drawn to sectors like IT, coding, data analytics, cybersecurity, actuarial science, accountancy. And this is where you actually want to have that high level of skill, predictable. You don't want this labor churn that many people are experiencing in those skills levels that organizations have many vacancies and are looking for. So when you say trustworthy, is it not that our context is actually doing the opposite? We're creating a context that's relying on hierarchy, on masking. ADHD, and particularly older women that are being diagnosed, have spent years masking, putting on a face, feeling absolutely drained at the end of the day because there's a sense of I'm overwhelmed, sensory, overwhelmed, social engagement. And how trustworthy is that environment then? Because you're not actually seeing the person. You're not actually seeing what that person can bring when they're not emotionally or otherwise drained. So this is also the contention where we can't just look at the individual and, you know, are we making an exception to include you? We need to turn the mirror on our organizations and say, what is this environment we're creating where we're actually killing people? Because there's this whole other game of power, this whole other game of who you include, who you exclude, how you position yourself to some people and to other people. And there's a whole level that actually drains a lot of energy and focus that perhaps is not trustworthy, because then in that game, again, maybe it's lip service organizations, and I've worked many years with culture change, will say we want creativity, we want psychological safety, we want innovation to be agile and future fit. But as you say, the inconvenience then, where maybe somebody calls truth to power, where somebody calls out what's not working, where we challenge a legacy project, where we come up with alternatives that don't match the hierarchical positioning, then it is not safe. It is not trustworthy. And so many people then stay in jobs and are completely disengaged. The Gallup survey findings that 62% of people are disengaged in work. And that under 35s are reporting a higher prevalence of loneliness in the workplace. And so this workplace is actually not a trustworthy place where we spend most of our time. So again, the contention being, if we find a truly inclusive culture that is challenging, it's not just fluff and we're nice to everybody, but actually has that space to speak what's required, what's not working, come up with new ideas, test. And we happen to also accommodate different styles of people engaging and different needs that individuals have. Then is that not a more aspirational or true reflection of what the culture would be like if we are in this future-focused organization?
Brilliant. And also what's being called out in us is to stop making specialists managers when they have no appetite to lead people, and so that there is still growth, aspiration, and reward over time, that you don't only get a promotion and more money if you're managing others. So you get real superstars, like companies spend significant amounts of money on those kind of brains as consultants. And I bet in many instances, that same quality of expertise, thinking, and value are within the organization, just hamstrung by the performance planning and review KPI world of existence. Because what was on my mind while you were talking about flipping the script around the trustworthy piece is that through an inherited dishonesty that we continue to perpetuate, is the status quo makes us believe that immunizes us from being honest.
What is real is the rise in burnout, the rise in anxiety, depression being the top killer of people over and above heart attacks, etc. This is real. This is a real worldwide global phenomenon, the rise in suicides of younger generations. And if you are neurodivergent, that burnout is real. It is such an interesting dichotomy where organizations are in denial. And again, your employee engagement survey might say to you, there's archaic autocrats, you know, will point out things in the written text, but yet when you're in the workshop, nobody will say anything. So there's a strange, such all power sense of belonging to this crafted organizational identity narrative. It is those teams that you know, and again, this is shown again and again, where there are spaces for that inclusion and belonging and generative conversation and generative feedback and generative ideation and generative improvement, that we know those organizations and teams do thrive. And there's many statistics around productivity and innovation being hundreds of percents higher than the rest. So there is a clear business case for this. And we also know there's a sense of fear from the people that are holding into those power positions of what it might mean to lose that, because there's been so much gained and tied into that. With technology and with a focus from human resources and career pathing, there's much more of a shift towards personalizing that experience. We don't all want the same pay grade. You know, I might want more leave and less money, or I might want to, as you say, switch career paths within the organization. Perhaps I'm a creative and I'm high on the ADHD or ADHD and I want to learn new things and move. We're sort of in the middle between what's possible in organizations, what we see, and holding on to what we have and know. We're in this space where we have choice of, will we as an organization speak up? I mean, I always say to organizations, are you really committed to this culture? Do you know where it's not working? And they'll say, yes, that manager, this context. I'll say, okay, well, before we do anything, I want to know, what are the consequences for those people? If you don't have any consequence for that manager that's running his ship like a tyrant and, you know, leaving wakes of bodies behind him, then how committed are you to this journey?
What do you want people and organizations to know who think that the whole neurodiversity context and debate is symptomatic of a world that is becoming less emotionally resilient with lower degrees of adaptability and fortitude?
Do you think there are lower degrees of resilience?
I don't know that, but what I do know, based on the conversations that I am regularly a part of, socially and professionally, is there is a broad perception from the older generations in work and society that younger generations are entitled and lack a societal toughness. What do you want people who have that mindset to know or to consider?
I'm really torn about the conversation about the younger generation, and I would definitely separate it out from the neurodiversity conversation. There is a sense of otherness amongst people that are neurodivergent, and there is a higher prevalence of neurodivergence amongst trans or people that are considering their identity from a sexual orientation point of view, or speaking up and more woke in terms of their individual needs and rights, etc. I just don't like the generalization about the younger people. You know, it just is so finite.
That's why I asked the question.
It has to be a yes or no. So if one thinks of more privileged children that have had access to more parents that are more helicopter, more directive, more supportive, more activities, more tech, more access to opportunities, on an anecdotal level, I would say, yes, there is a real thing around I've been buffered, I've been given extra time, I've been given extra resources. The more I need, the more I ask. And actually, resilience might be, how do I survive without that? And I have many friends and children that have crashed and burnt when they're in the real world, because the capability of, you make a plan, it's up to you, the environment won't always be absorbing your needs, nor even interested in what your needs are. But having said that, I also know of young adults that have showed huge resilience in completely changing careers, in completely exploring alternate work patterns of work a bit, play a bit, portfolio of income, traveling and working. So the youth are meant to be pushing the boundaries of what should be and shouldn't be. So I think that's sort of a role of youth in society. So I would miss that if we didn't have that. And then on the other hand, for the majority of the population in emerging markets, one cannot say there's no resilience, because just to get through school, to get employment, is resilience par excellence. Challenges to just get work, you know, let alone leave school, let alone get through university, are extraordinary. So if anything, I have utmost admiration for people that have come through lack of privilege to the workplace.
I've got a vivid visual image, Sarah, of if an individual or a group's worldview is a camera on a tripod. What you do so beautifully is quickly swing the camera on the tripod 380 degrees. Instead of the lens being inside looking out, it can be inside looking inside or outside looking inside. It's such a beautiful thing, because that is what is required for us to learn. And it's easy to talk about diversity and oversimplify it. Any difference is a diversity.
This is why your questioning is so powerful too, because it gets to the underlying dynamics and insights of what's going on. What is that difference, or what is that perspective? We don't pause enough to do that, because we jump to that photograph as opposed to the process of photographing.
What practical approach should we focus on to build a neuro-inclusive climate in our organization?
Super. I would say there are three legs. The first is awareness, awareness, awareness around our diversities, the hidden, unseen diversities, what that means, the strengths and the challenges, and how we are all part of this, and the benefits of actually having a neuroinclusive. There's such a strong business case for it, let alone the human case for it. Secondly, build capacity in your human resources, your talent, have a community of practice that really looks at the climate in all parts of the business, but also the policies, the procedures, the systems, from attracting talent to managing talent to promoting to retaining. So the whole pipeline of that, and train managers in some of the behavioral etiquette on how to work with neurodivergence, but also neurodiversity in your teams, because it boils down to each manager and their team. So that's very practical. The third thing is have some level of support, so that you're not just raising awareness and then not supporting either through coaching, an employee resource group, and allowing other groups to emerge where there can be support. Coaching around how to advocate for the individual, how to look at what I'm needing to transition roles, perhaps, or so very practical, but coaching specifically for the neurodiverse individuals. And the support community allows for shared experience, for sharing tips and tools, for even just sharing frustrations. So there's a space for the neurodivergent community to actually have a space of support, but also to have a collective voice. So there might be some common needs that come through in the employee resource group, for example. So when you are making decisions as a company, you have a pool to go to that doesn't isolate an individual because they've now, there's a whole discussion around disclosure, but where an individual might self-disclose, you also don't want them to feel put on the pedestal or now put in the spotlight and treated differently. So the sense of numbers and collectives and support is just as important. So the three legs of awareness, of building capacity and support would be very practical steps.
If this conversation resonated with you, check out the other episodes on CoCurious. Visit us online at learningadvisory.com and let's keep learning, let's keep sharing, and let's keep holding each other to account for the advancement of ourselves and practicing what we teach.